What exactly is consciousness? Is consciousness something that is distinctly human? Will AI ever be conscious? This week, neuroscientist and consciousness expert Anil Seth on 9 Questions with Eric Oliver.
Hi, Dre. How are you?
Hi, Eric. Good morning. How are you doing?
I am good. I just got back from Puerto Rico, which I love.
Yeah.
Surf all day, salsa all night.
Exactly. That's the island life.
That is. It's wonderful there. Love it. People are so lovely. So
yeah, they are.
Yeah.
So tell me, how do you know you're conscious?
Oh, well, how would I be otherwise?
I don't know. It's a genuine question.
Yeah, it is. And it's actually a really thorny question.
Yeah.
And it's been something I've been pondering now for 57 years.
And in many of our episodes.
And in many episodes and in many recreational activities.
Yeah.
And it's a tough thing to wrap our heads around. I mean, it's mm-hmm. probably the big eternal question of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, how do we know what defines this experience of being that we have?
Yeah.
And philosophers and poets have grappled with this for centuries, and we still don't have a clear answer.
Yeah.
So luckily, though, this week's guest is someone who's going to try to help us through this. So can you introduce Anil to everyone?
Yes. Anil Seth is a British neuroscientist and professor of cognitive and computational neuroscience at the University of Sussex. He's published over 100 scientific papers, is the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Neuroscience of Consciousness, and the author of the best-selling book Being You, and an incredibly intelligent human being.
Yes, I first came across Anil. He has a TED Talk that has like a gazillion views.
Yes.
And he, in the TED Talk, he basically says, is life just this big hallucination? And he basically tries to explain what the neuroscience is behind this experience of being that we're having.
Mm-hmm.
And I think based on the popularity of that talk, he got a book contract and wrote this terrific book, Being You, which I just assigned in a seminar I was leading last semester on the evolution of consciousness, because this was something I wanted to explore. And I had some really smart grad students and undergrads to explore with.
Mm.
And we love this book. And Anil's in really high demand. So I was very excited when he said, sure, I'll talk to you. And we ended up having this remarkably long conversation, which you've done a fantastic job of distilling down to 40 minutes.
Thank you.
And I know that was difficult. And I just, as a warning to listeners, this is a pretty high-level conversation in terms of both the subject matter and how we're approaching it.
Yeah.
But this was, for me, a really exciting opportunity to talk to one of the world's leading experts on consciousness and how we should go about even thinking about consciousness, how we should define it, can we define it, and how do we explain it? How do we explain what's going on? And both in his book and in our interview, he goes through and describes how we might think about consciousness and how he tries to measure consciousness, particularly looking at people, say, for example, who are in vegetative states. Can we tell whether or not there's consciousness kind of underneath that? And ideas about how we might even expand our consciousness. So this was just a really, really intense, engaging and stimulating conversation. And it's probably one of those conversations that you'll miss a lot on the first time. You might need to listen to it a couple of times.
Yeah.
To kind of get the
full
grasp.
But it's worth it. Yeah.
It's worth it. And he's a really special person and a really remarkable scientist. And so it's a great treat to be able to share this conversation with him. So Anil, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. This is a great pleasure for me to chat with you. And I want to start with this question of consciousness, that it seems that we all have this kind of intuitive sense of consciousness. And you know, a lot of philosophers talk about this, a sense of kind of qualia or experience of being. And I think we oftentimes try to understand understand consciousness writ large from our own experience. And I was wondering if you could take us through how this intuitive sense of consciousness may mislead us. Where does it take us right and where does it take us wrong?
It's a very good place to start. because there's no good answer to it, I don't think, at the moment. People have interpreted how we might be misled by our intuitions about consciousness in all sorts of ways. You know, from one extreme, suggesting that consciousness almost doesn't exist even. There's no real problem about how consciousness fits into a very mechanistic picture of the brain. You know, all the way to thinking that consciousness is everywhere and part of everything. From my perspective, a good starting point to think about consciousness is to accept that it exists. You know, there's something going on in at least some living creatures which makes them more than just complicated objects. You know, they are also the subjects of experience. Experiencing is going on, as Thomas Nagel puts it. There is something it is like to be a conscious organism. But for a non-conscious system, there is nothing it is that it is like to be that system. But beyond that, I think our intuitions can get us into trouble. Like, one intuition is that the self is the essence of a person that is doing the experiencing, that is, you know, literally the subject of experience and is then making decisions based on their experience, doing something, controlling the body in some ways, a kind of inner homunculus. I mean, that's been a very long-standing view on what the nature of the self is, but a view that's increasingly challenged in neuroscience, but has long been challenged in other traditions, in a lot of the more spiritual traditions too. So I think we can be very misled when we take the contents of consciousness to be reliable insights into the nature of reality, basically the how things seem and how things are. How things seem is really not always how they are. The same goes, in a sense, for our experiences of the world. It seems that the world just reveals itself to us in all its splendor of colors and shapes and so on. But of course, that's not the case. The brain is constructing this experience. Things like colors don't have a mind-independent existence. So this naive realism that our conscious encounter with the world has, that colors are just there, I mean, that's also misleading. So I think it's just important to recognize that, yes, consciousness exists and it can go away, you know, under anesthesia, and some, but maybe not all, other animals have it. But that the nature of phenomenology, that the way in which conscious experiences unfold, may set us off down the wrong tracks if we take it too literally.
Well, maybe this is a good point for question two here, since we're talking about consciousness and it's such an elusive phenomenon. And maybe we could try to come up with a definition. And I was wondering if you have a kind of a simple working definition.
Well, I use the one that Thomas Nagel, I've mentioned it already, that for a conscious organism, there is something it is like to be that organism. It's a very straightforward definition. You might think it's circular. It's basically saying that for conscious organisms, there is consciousness happening. And is that really helpful? Well, you know, I think it's helpful in that it has some intuitive grip. Like, we know what consciousness is to some extent by familiarity with when it goes away. If we fall into a dreamless sleep or if we go under anesthesia, there's a sense of, well, it's consciousness that has gone and that comes back when we come around again or wake up again. And so that fits the definition. It's not a very explanatory definition. Like, you know, you can think at least of two kinds of definition. Again, in the history of science, you have definitions of heat in terms of the mean molecular kinetic energy of the molecules or atoms in a substance. And that's great, but comes much further down the line. Now, that wasn't where definitions of heat started. You know, definitions of heat started much more phenomenologically, of things feeling hot or cold. And so I think a similar strategy again applies here, that to start with, the definition must be quite broad and nonspecific. Otherwise, we risk sort of building in a prospective answer to the question of how consciousness happens without anything to justify doing that.
Great. I want to be a little self-indulgent here, if you don't mind. And I have a kind of a working definition of consciousness, and I wanted to run this by you and see what you thought of, which is consciousness as a collection of systemic processes that organize information to enable deliberate action.
It certainly appeals to me in the sense that my own ideas about consciousness are very firmly grounded in biological function and in homeostasis and allostasis and the preservation, the sort of anticipatory preservation of the organism. But there's a big difference between that definition and the kind of definition I was offering, mm-hmm. which is your definition is basically a theory of consciousness rather than the definition of it. You know, you're not describing.
Well, that begs the question, aren't those things always connected?
Well, they ought to be connected, but it just depends where you want to start. Uh-huh. So that definition in terms of collection of processes that have a particular function, I mean, that does beg the question of, okay, the assertion there is anything that exhibits those organized processes would be conscious because it's your definition of consciousness. So you don't allow for the fact there might be systems that do that are not conscious.
Well, I mean, this begs the question of sort of inorganic energy systems. If insofar as you can imagine some inorganic energy system that is making deliberate choices, my thought behind this is that what consciousness is doing, when an organism is performing consciousness, it's having to make a kind of a system-wide set of choices. Consciousness there is a process that enables it as an entire system to act in a particular way. So, you know, take a cell. So a cell has lots of constituent parts to it. All of those constituent parts are processing information in very individualistic ways. So there's all, you know, a myriad of different kind of chemical reactions taking place within a cell. Yet a cell still has to exist kind of coherently. And, you know, even bacteria will make a particular choice. They have a choice set. Our own individual cells in our body have choice sets about, you know, whether or not to reproduce, for example. And then, you know, you take us up to a multicellular creature. It has to then coordinate all of the efforts amongst its constituent cellular parts. And so that becomes a kind of consciousness. And this is where I think cognition then arises, because what, you know, these are animals that have cognitive systems in order to, you know, coordinate amongst their constituent parts. So yeah, I'm firmly rooted in this kind of biological idea of consciousness, but it seems to me that that's like consciousness is about the coordination of all of these elements in order to really formulate a will and to enable some sort of choice. Now, I think it's a constrained will. There's, you know, there's a set of choices that it has, but there's nevertheless some sort of will and choice making. Because if you didn't really have to make choices or integrate information, there would be no need for an experience of being. There'd be no need for awareness.
Yeah, I mean, you might well be right about that. And I think, you know, I think you probably are. It aligns very much with not only my ideas about this, but I think other thinkers, researchers in consciousness science as well, that it has a function. Its function, by and large, is to integrate a lot of survival relevant information for an organism in the kind of format that sort of highlights opportunities for action, shapes maybe choice making, maybe action in particular ways. And so we experience things out there in the world in the context of our body, in the context of emotion and mood, which is sort of ways of representing threats to survival or opportunities for thriving based on what's going on around us. And it's all together in one single form. So I think that's very much on the right track. But I just think we need to be careful about what we call a theory and what we call a definition. If you assert this as the case for consciousness, then you're already closing off questions about whether any system that does that is conscious or not. You know, you're just saying it happens by definition, in the same way that panpsychists by definition would say that consciousness is built fundamentally into the universe. And I try and resist doing that as much as possible and make these things, to the extent that is feasible, open and potentially empirically addressable questions. It may not be the case for me. I would not be confident in saying that every system that, you know, regulates its action in this way is conscious. That to me is not warranted by what we know about consciousness based simply on the analysis of human beings, where it's surprisingly easy to lose consciousness. Mm-hmm. You know, it can go away. So of course that's a different situation from a fully intact but simpler creature. You can't infer that consciousness isn't there just because it's easy to go away, easy to abolish in humans. But also, I think it's dangerous to assume It's just dangerous to build in the sufficient conditions for consciousness into a definition of consciousness. I think because we don't really know, even in a human brain, what the necessary and sufficient mechanisms are, I prefer to define consciousness in terms of its manifest features, you know, the phenomenology of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the theory part is, well, how does that relate to what's going on from other perspectives on the same system, from its homeostatic, allostatic properties, from its embodiment and embeddedness? And maybe out of that, then you get explanations of, I think you do get explanations of why, for us, we have experiences of what we call agency, will, volition. But again, without falling into the trap, as in the first question, of taking those experiences as literal insights into how things are. You know, the experience of free will does not mean that there's an immaterial me parachuting in and changing the course of physical events. You know, it's just an experience that has useful characteristics for the organism in the same way that color experiences have useful characteristics for an organism.
I'm really curious about this because I rarely get a chance to talk to someone about it. So if we could push a little more into this, because I'm wondering about this notion, and I was trying to think of the analogy of a vision and color, and sort of say, well, what is color? And, you know, we might say, well, you know, color is the, you know, the wavelength of a certain, you know, radiant signature that's out there, or light wave that's out there. And that's, you know, then we interpret that as color. And I'm wondering if, you know, is that similarly problematic in terms of, you know, we're defining color, the definition of color, by a theory. And I'm wondering if it's analogous to this, you know, idea with consciousness here in some ways. That I guess this is always my concern with the Nagel definition of consciousness, is that it ends up just being in some ways a synonym for the phenomena we're trying to describe.
If you were to define, say, red is this wavelength, you know, we've got these three types of color receptors in our eyes that sort of have their peak sensitivity at different wavelengths. And so we call them red, green, and blue as a sort of shorthand. But the wavelength isn't actually red or green or blue, right? They're just different right. wavelengths of light. And of course, you know, different people may experience different colors for the same activity levels in those receptors. Different species might have totally different color experiences altogether. So yes, we would be misled if we defined color in terms of a wavelength of light. You know, we're misunderstanding something very basic here, which is that electromagnetic radiation is not colored.
Yeah, it's our just our interpretation of that, and you know, we generate that in that way.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you this question about this. So if we think about consciousness as a process, is that going to be a process going to be specific to creatures, i.e. animals, that have dedicated neural systems? Or could we say that, for example, plants or fungi perform consciousness?
I think we just have to, a lot of these questions, I feel kind of embarrassed I think it's not possible to give good answers to these questions. So I sort of feel a bit of embarrassment on the behalf of the whole effort to understand consciousness. So there are people that would say, yeah, you know, why are we so anthropocentric? And we think about consciousness from a human perspective and deny it to other living things. And of course, there's a history here where human beings have denied the goods of consciousness to even other humans, but certainly other animals. And these days, I think views that plants are conscious is a very minority view, but it might be the right view. I think it's just impossible to know for sure at the moment. I'm skeptical, and the reason I'm skeptical is that consciousness in humans seems to be associated with a nervous system. I mean, that's one of our starting points, right? So seems to be associated with a brain, and only part of that brain. I mean, the cerebellum, which has got 3/4 of all your neurons, doesn't seem to be much involved in consciousness at all. And it's easy to lose. You interrupt the behavior of these neurons in specific ways and consciousness goes away. So it could be that that's just one specific way of manifesting consciousness, and that it's what, as the philosophers would say, it's multiply realizable in different systems in different ways. But right now, we don't have a theory with sufficiently high credence that we could say that it generalizes to plants or trees. And they may not face the same functional challenges as well. I mean, your argument, again, was consciousness does useful things for us in the sense of as allowing us to respond to our environments in flexible, goal-oriented, homeostasis-preserving ways. Do plants face these same kinds of challenges? Now, does evolution need to hit on to need to solve the same kind of functional problems?
Well, one example I would have with plants is that, you know, plants don't grow from a fixed body plan. So they basically grow to where the light is. And so if we think about that as it's a different kind of information processing and a different kind of deliberative action than what we would normally think, because they're sessile, when not mobile. But nevertheless, there is some choice mechanisms that are occurring within the plant of like, oh, do I sprout here or not sprout there?
Yeah. And I don't want to be mean about plants. They're fascinating, especially if you slow down the time scale at which you look at them, and you know, they behave. They do all kinds of fascinating things. I mean, some of them are indeed motile. Some they move around if you wait long enough. And then, of course, they leverage our anthropomorphic tendencies, and we start to project all these kinds of new qualities into plants because we see them move. But are those reliable? Probably not. Now, it could be that there is something it is like to be a daffodil, but I'm just not yet convinced of any positive reason to believe that. And we're having a hard enough time figuring out the limits of consciousness in non-human animals. I think as we develop a better mechanistic understanding of how consciousness comes together in us, in humans, we have the tools to put those pieces together in different ways and understand a bit more about what the wider space of minds might look like. But we shouldn't make the mistake of asking too much, of saying, well, we don't know, unless we can actually be a daffodil, we don't know what it would be like to be a daffodil at all. I mean, we'll never, that's setting the bar way too high. We don't need to instantiate these things in order to have some kind of epistemological grip on them.
There are a lot of different theories about consciousness that are out there. And I was wondering if you could just maybe elucidate for our audience what you think are the most productive theories. Or productive models, maybe, that are out there, and maybe explain them?
Yeah, it's an interesting time in the field now. There's a bunch of theories. Some people would say there are too many theories of consciousness, which is just, I think that's a reasonable criticism. And there's been an effort to compare different theories against each other now and trim the field down a little bit. I don't know how successful that will be, but that's an ongoing effort, these so-called adversarial collaborations with it pitting different theories against each other. What's interesting is that the most prominent theories out there are not particularly commensurable. That is, they are often theories of different things. They make different assumptions or have starting definitions, different definitions about consciousness, and they make different assumptions about necessary, sufficient conditions and so on. I think there are four main groupings. One grouping is the global workspace collection of theories. And these are probably the most popular overall. And this may be because of their amenability to experimental test. So the global workspace theory broadly says that consciousness happens when information gains access to a distributed network of processing across the brain, including the frontal cortex, the parietal cortex. It's very much a theory of how consciousness happens in mammalian or human brains, mm-hmm. not how it happens in general. So it says for systems that have brains like ours, when signals go beyond where they're locally processed, let's say in visual cortex or auditory cortex, they only enter consciousness, and there's a lot slipped in with that word, enter consciousness, when these signals start bouncing around through the global workspace. And in doing that, they have the potential to be used very flexibly. And this aligns with some of our intuitions about consciousness, that when we're conscious of something out there in the world or in the body, then we can behave very flexibly with respect to that. We can pay attention to it. We can talk about it. We can remember it. It has that kind of wide cognitive access that unconscious perceptions don't seem to have. So that's the global workspace theory. It has these two fundamental criteria of ignition of the workspace and broadcast within the workspace. Its main critics would say it's not really a theory about consciousness. It's more a theory about the cognitive functions that go along with consciousness some of the time. Then there's also higher order theories. There's a bunch of these, and they propose that consciousness happens when some sort of mental state is re-represented by another mental state as being conscious. This always sounds a bit circular. Mm-hmm. You know, I've been persuaded that it isn't, but it does sound a bit strange. So you know, there might be part of my brain like representing that the color red is out there in the world, but for redness to happen as conscious experience, there would have to be another mental state kind of in some way pointing at that first mental state or making an inference about it with the content that that first mental state is conscious. How does that actually make consciousness happen? I don't know.
Well, is that, and maybe I'm getting ahead of myself here, but I'm wondering, one of the things that you write about in the book really well is this notion of kind of hallucination of self. And if we think about one of the things that we have to do is this kind of very complex multicellular organism is have a general feeling of coherence. It's a way of negotiating with the world. And so it's evolved in our species to the point that we have a distinct experience of self. It's typically a very egoistic kind of experience. I feel like there's an I, there's a me here, and I know this me through my cognition. And my intuition is that that exists in some ways prior and separate from the thoughts that are then, you know, pumping up into view. But that, of course, that whole experience is itself a process that's being fabricated by my mind.
No, I mean, this brings us on to the third sort of group of theories, really, which are these predictive processing theories. And that's where I'd place myself within that camp. And these are theories that, well, they're not really theories of consciousness, which is why I find them quite appealing. That theory is that treat the brain as a prediction machine that is making predictions about the causes of sensory signals for the purposes of control, regulation, calibration with the environment, and so on. And the origins of predictive processing as a view go way back in both control theory and also in psychology. And I think they are useful for consciousness research because they provide the resources to connect properties of mechanisms to properties of consciousness. All of our perceptual predictions are ultimately grounded in their relevance for keeping the body alive. So the reason we have this predictive machinery inside our brains can be traced in evolution and development and in moment-to-moment operation in light of this fundamental biological imperative for homeostasis and allostasis. So I think it's a very rich resource, but it's not a theory of consciousness in the sense of proposing necessary and sufficient conditions. And just to draw a line under this question, then there's integrated information theory, which is the fourth group of theories, which is a very different kind of theory. Again, it starts from phenomenology, like what a conscious experience is like, and then makes inferences about what kinds of systems have those properties. And so we go from consciousness to mechanism rather than the other way around. This is a theory that's been fairly controversial, but it is probably the most comprehensive of all the theories of consciousness that are out there at the moment. Like, it makes very specific claims about when a system is conscious, how much consciousness a system might have, and what a system might be conscious of. None of these claims are testable at the moment in any way, but at least it makes them.
Can you give us an example of one of those claims? Like, what would be one of those testable claims?
Oh, well, they're not.
Okay, what would be one of its specific claims then?
Well, basically, the theory has this fundamental central claim that consciousness is identical to irreducible maxima of integrated information. Now, I'm not going to unpack mathematically what that means. Basically, it means there are some systems where the whole is more than the sum of the parts in some mathematically precise way. And wherever that is true, there will be consciousness. And the specific way in which the whole is more than the sum of the parts will determine what that system is conscious of.
Well, this raises a question for me. I'd be very fascinated to hear your response, which is we oftentimes hear that consciousness is an emergent phenomena, that it's more than the sum of its parts. Can we ever know if something is more than the sum of its parts?
I think so.
Can you share what you would say would be a handy example of that?
Well, a good example that comes to my mind. I mean, it's a very slippery concept, by the way. Let me just say that first. Emergence has caused all kinds of problems in physics and philosophy and biology over the years, because it seems to have also this potentially spooky connotation that, like, things that are emerge are not traceable to their parts in a way that might seem to violate the principles of ontological reduction on which science rests. But I think there is a sensible way to think about things still. A good example is a flock of birds. So I live in Brighton, and in the winter evenings, like about now probably, over the pier, there'll be this murmuration of starlings where thousands of individual birds come together and start whirling around in the sky. But they don't do it randomly, and they don't do it in strict formation either. The flock is this sort of shape that seems to have an entity, an autonomy, an agency of its own. And it seems to be something that is more than the sum of the birds that make it up. Now, is this just in the eye of the beholder? Maybe it is. After all, there is nothing more than just birds flying around and responding to their environment. So in that sense, yes, there's nothing more than birds, individual birds flying around. However, I still think there's a very interesting difference between that flock and when the birds are flying randomly or in formation. And that difference is something you can mathematically quantify. We can figure out different ways that we might measure it. And they map onto something interesting out there. You know, a bird in a flock is reacting to its environment, but the flock is part of its environment. So, you know, there are these ways in which the whole constrains the behavior of the parts. You know, just as an air molecule in the middle of a hurricane is affected by the fact that there's a hurricane, you know, even though there's nothing that need violate the laws of physics in the molecule just responding to the forces that immediately impinge on it. So it could well be that, you know, neurons think instead of birds in a flock, we have neurons in a brain. And in some states, they may do something a little like flocking. We already know that, you know, neurons synchronize. We have these waves, these oscillations. But there may be other interesting ways in which the whole is more than the sum of the parts, which may be interesting windows on aspects of consciousness. And I think the unity of consciousness, the fact that conscious experiences typically are unified, we have one rich conscious experience at one time, you know, that seems to mesh quite neatly with this idea of something that has a unity at a higher level of description than just the individual parts. Integrated information, actually, you can think of it as a version of emergence. It can also be thought of as a measure of emergence, but it's a very, it differs in the mathematical details of how it's expressed. But in my group, we've worked on, and with my colleagues, we've worked on a number of different formalizations of emergence, which when we try them out in simulation models, we see actually there's like many different ways to think about this, and these different measures pick up on different aspects of this mereological whole part relationship.
This actually then segues really nicely to the next question I wanted to ask you, and it was about human consciousness and some of the efforts that you've been undertaking to measure human consciousness in terms of neural synchronicity. And I was wondering if you could describe that in terms of how we know, for example, if someone who's in a vegetative state is conscious or not, and what sort of new technologies in terms of measuring brain waves can tell us about that.
Yeah, it's a great question because, you know, we've been talking a lot in the abstract, but consciousness science being about probably the most central phenomenon in any of our lives, and in life, consciousness is what gives our lives value and meaning, the science should have some relevance in practice too. And it's exciting that it does. Now, it would be nice to just be able to measure whether a brain injured patient is conscious or not, you know, with the same kind of confidence that we can measure the temperature of anything by sticking a thermometer in it. Now, we're not quite there yet, but progress is being made. The problem with somebody in a vegetative state is that they can't behaviorally respond to anything. So they may look as if they're unconscious, but maybe that's just a deficit with behavioral expression. And and language and so on. So there's been two basic approaches to address this question of whether a behaviorally non-responsive human patient might still have residual consciousness. On the one hand, you've got these kind of active approaches, and these are incredibly creative. And my colleague Adrian Owens, very famous for one of these experiments, which involved asking patients to imagine either walking around their house or playing tennis, which is a strange thing because they don't make any response at all.
Yeah.
But the brain networks underlying these acts of imagination are very different and highly separable in brain imaging. So you can see if someone's engaging in this voluntary mental imagery. And the inference is, well, the assumption is if they're doing that, they must be conscious because there's no evidence that anyone could do that unconsciously. We can't imagine walking around our house for a period of a minute unless we are actually conscious. Failure on these tests does not reliably indicate lack of consciousness, but passing a test fairly reliably indicates presence. So you need a range of things. And some of the more passive measures, back to these measures of sort of brain complexity and so on, that are based a little bit on this idea of emergence of integrated information. You know, there you don't need the patient's explicit cooperation. You just see what the brain dynamics are. So those can be more sensitive, but they might be less specific because maybe maybe someone will display those brain dynamics and still not be conscious. It depends on how much you believe in your theory at that point.
So there's a lot of interest now with AI systems and the question of, you know, whether or not there will be artificial consciousness with AI systems. I'm curious to hear your views on that.
I'm skeptical about that. And I'm skeptical for a few reasons. I think there is anthropocentrism creeping back in here again. So, you know, we humans tend to think we're exceptional and we think we're very intelligent, you know, compared to our, and to associate consciousness and intelligence to the extent that it's not totally widespread, but there is this assumption in the AI community that consciousness is a function of intelligence. And when AI reaches a particular threshold of intelligence, bingo, the inner lights come on and we have systems that not only behave with intelligence, but they've experienced things too. I just don't buy that premise. I think that derives from combination of human exceptionalism, anthropocentrism, and anthropomorphism, our tendency to project qualities into things on the basis of similarities which may not be particularly relevant. And then there's another big assumption, which is that consciousness is the kind of thing that a computer could have if programmed the right way, doing the right kind of information processing. This is a very widespread assumption throughout not only computer science and AI, but also neuroscience and philosophy. And it's the assumption of what's often called computational functionalism, that the right kind of information processing is sufficient for consciousness. And I just, again, I'm not saying it's wrong, but I think it's an open question. And it could well be that computation information processing is not sufficient for consciousness.
You know, I like Schrodinger's definition of life as, you know, that energy system that's resisting entropy. So yeah. If we were to then fabricate some kind of artificial system that had its own energy core, was looking to draw in free energy to sustain itself, had some sort of homeostatic set point that it was trying to maintain, reproducing itself over time, that to me would be then the prerequisite for then some sort of consciousness processes to begin happening within that system.
I think that's a reasonable theory. Yeah. I mean, so there's another perspective called carbon chauvinism, which is consciousness can only happen for carbon-based life forms. And I think, again, well, maybe that's going a bit too far. It could be that consciousness is a property of living systems because of this maybe obligatory relationship between consciousness and the self-creation, self-preservation, almost autopoetic behavior of the substrate. Like, I think for me, the key thing is in living systems, there's no clear definition of substrate and what's implemented on the substrate. You know, living systems are fundamentally metabolic systems. They recreate their own components, you know, over time, and they don't just have things running on their components.
Right.
That is for me a very critical difference. And of course, one of my frustrations is I'm not thought of any way to test this claim, but it it makes sense. At least it conceptually, I think, has some force. But yes, you could build if you could build systems like that out of other kinds of matter, then fine. That would also be all right.
A final question for you. In a lot of spiritual traditions, there's an idea of expansion of consciousness, which with respect to transcendence or, you know, some sort of higher state of being. And I was wondering if you have any insights, given your research into consciousness, like from either a neurological perspective, what does it mean to expand consciousness? Or is expansion of consciousness even a scientific concept in that way?
I think this brings us nicely back round to where we started, which is how our intuitions of consciousness may mislead us. And one of the ways, as we've mentioned, is to take very literally the contents of our experience as reflecting objective reality, and combined with that, to assume that there's just one way of being conscious, and that's the way that we are in general from day to day. And for me, a useful way to understand this idea of expanding one's consciousness is to become more aware of the possibility of different ways of being conscious, different possible states. And this can be as trivial as, again, recognizing that somebody else might be experiencing the same shared room that they're in different ways, seeing different colors, hearing the sounds differently, and so on. Just breaking out of our perceptual echo chambers to realize that there are other ways of experiencing the world and the self. We can do this cognitively by just thinking about it and realizing and studying neuroscience and psychology and all these things. Or we can do it through first-person practice. And I think this is where the spiritual traditions also come in, because meditation can be used in this way. You know, it can introduce a little gap for us between how things seem and how we interpret how things seem. Most meditation practices have in common encouraging through practice the ability to reflect on experience rather than be drawn along by experience. And then other methods also, such as psychedelics, again, they don't necessarily remove the filters and reveal the world, the universe more accurately, but they certainly show us that there are filters, but there are always filters. There are just different ones on psychedelics. But I think the experience of psychedelics can often be, oh, it brings it into the first person that what we experience is not just a direct reflection of what's there. It's this active, constructive process. You know, we see something, we experience something of the mechanism under the influence of psychedelics. That, I think, is a useful way to interpret it, as cultivating a little bit of a humility about any particular way of experiencing the world and recognizing the existence of a much richer space of ways of seeing, ways of hearing, ways of being, not just within humans, but with other animals too.
Thank you so much. I think that's a great note to end on. I'm fascinated by this. I could have this conversation go on for hours from my perspective. This is just great. So thank you so much for all your insights and your great work and coming on the podcast. Really appreciated talking to you.
Eric, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks. Thanks for having me.
If you feel like you're getting a lot out of our show, there's another University of Chicago Podcast Network show you should check out. It's called Why This Universe. Why This Universe breaks down the biggest ideas in physics. Join theoretical physicist Dan Hooper and soon-to-be physicist Shalma Wegsman as they answer your questions about dark matter, black holes, quantum mechanics, and more on Why This Universe. Part of the award-winning University of Chicago Podcast Network.